Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Drew Hutton, an environmental campaigner in his home state of Queensland, Australia. He founded the Greens Party in his state of Queensland and was a co-founder of the Australian Greens nationally in 1992. Drew was the main spokesperson for the Queensland Greens from 1990 to 2007. He's currently the spokesperson for Friends of the Earth Brisbane and is an organiser of the Lock the Gate campaign, an alliance of environmentalists and rural land owners and farmers opposing the environmental destruction by coal and coal seam gas mining in Queensland. He's also the author, with his wife Libby Connors, of A History of the Australian Environmental Movement, published by Cambridge University Press in 1999. Drew Hutton, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Hi, Helen.
Now, I specifically wanted to interview you, Drew, because of the recent catastrophic floods in Queensland, and they weren't just confined to Queensland. They were also in the state of New South Wales and in Victoria and in Tasmania. In other words, this is really an unheard-of situation in the recorded history of Australia. Would you like to tell us about the floods, the impacts they've had, how much was flooded, and the like, please, Drew Hutton?
Sure. Well, they were momentous, these floods. Not completely unprecedented, because Queensland's actually had two similar flooding events in the last 100 years, two others. But the scale of these is probably larger than any before. 80% of the state was actually flood affected at the height of all of this.
And it's a huge state. What's the size of Queensland? Oh. Can you compare it to Texas?
Oh, I think it would be at least as big as Texas.
Oh, I think much bigger.
Yes, I do too.
Yeah.
It would be a good proportion of the United States of America, actually. A good proportion of the size of the country would be Queensland, I think.
No, that's going a bit far.
That's going a bit far? Yeah,
all right. Equaled Germany and France, I think, in area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, it's very big anyway.
Yeah.
And the major catchments of the entire state were actually flooded. So that created enormous problems. We had billions of dollars of damage to businesses and homes and various enterprises. And the infrastructure of the state was wrecked. Basically, our rail systems, at least in southern Queensland, will be out of action for the next 4 or 5 months.
Oh, boy.
While they get repaired. And even our road systems are going to take some time to get back online. So, no, they were momentous, and they'll continue to have impacts for years to come, I suspect.
And what about the crops?
Well, farmers in southern Queensland and in central Queensland lost basically all of their wheat, all of their winter wheat crops. I think it was over 40% of the... No, only 40% of the cotton crop survived. The only crop that really managed to hold up was sorghum, which is a bit more a bit more steadfast in the face of challenges like this. And so they've it's been able to survive. But chickpeas, a whole lot of them just simply died. In fact, some of them died even before the major flooding occurred. We've had such a wet season.
Yeah, it's interesting though, isn't it, that for about 10 years Australia's been suffering a severe, severe drought. And then there's a poem by an Australian author called Dorothy McKellar, and she talks about a land of drought and flooding rains, and it certainly is that.
Well, Dorothy McKellar's been quoted often over the last few weeks. And terror was felt by a lot of people. At one stage, some water after a heavy rainfall event, swept down the mountain from one of our larger cities, Toowoomba, which is on a range, and just swept through these townships at the bottom of the range. You know, it was just basically an 8-metre wall of water racing straight through these villages, and it killed over 30 people, between 30 and 40 people.
Yeah, they just got washed away in their cars.
In their homes. They just didn't know what hit them, a lot of those people.
And babies were washed out of mothers' arms.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it was just dreadful, yeah. But I have an office at a little Friends of the Earth has an office at a little place called Warra, which is out on the Darling Downs in the middle of floodplain country. And the Condamine River is about 5 kilometres away from the office, and I had water up to the floorboards.
Did you really?
So it just comes straight across that plain, yeah. They don't call it a floodplain for nothing, Helen.
Now, I know there are explanations abounding, but it seems to the climate scientists that these events are becoming more frequent. If you look at the trend, and certainly the Arctic ice is melting faster than anyone predicted, and the temperatures in the Arctic Circle are 3 to 4 degrees above anything expected. And meanwhile, the Arctic air has moved down to North America, and they're having the most freezing winter. It's kind of, Drew, reminds me of a patient where if one thing goes wrong, say you develop cardiomyopathy and your heart doesn't pump properly, that can impact kidneys because you've had acute nephritis as a child, secondary to streptococcal infection, so you might go into renal failure, and that'll affect the liver, you know, and so it's an ongoing thing, but not necessarily predicted by the doctors. And so the planet's kind of like that. We're in a massive global experiment, would you think?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that now. We do have what we call here in South America, I'm not too sure whether North American audiences are familiar with it, what they call El Nino and La Nina.
Yeah, describe those
weather events. Well,
yeah.
El Nino is when the I can never remember which is which. I think it's when the Pacific waters are fairly cold in this part of the world and hot over in the Americas. And that's when we get drought. Whereas La Nina is when the water warms up and we get a lot more precipitation. And so that's when we get floods. So it's not uncommon for there to be periods like that. And we had El Nino during the period from about 2001 to 2009, when we had drought,
yep.
Severe drought right across the country. But and now we've got El Nino with all these floods. But there's no doubt that the variability is much greater than it was before. I mean, we've never had extensive flooding like this, and we've never had the sort of drought that we've had. Which went on for about 9 years straight.
Yeah. Also the scientists are saying the water is warmer than it's been in any other El Nino event.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And
well, that causes extra precipitation.
Yeah,
more
that's
water
right.
goes into the atmosphere.
It causes more evaporation. So, yeah. All right. So we've had disastrous consequences, yet during this whole catastrophe, I was amazed, shocked, that Queensland is the biggest exporter of coal almost in the world, that they're digging Queensland up left, right and centre, while James Hansen, the father, godfather of global warming, says the most concentrated form of carbon to be emitted into the atmosphere is coal.
Yes.
Can you expound on that a bit, please?
Well, I can expound on it. I can't possibly rationalise it. It's the most bizarre and culpable sort of activity that a government can undertake. And I think the current Queensland government will go down in history as a bunch of criminals, really, for what they're doing. Not only are we a massive coal producer, in fact, as you rightly say, I think the biggest provincial coal producer in the world, but we're expanding at an unprecedented rate. And in fact, we've got something like 37, maybe over 40 by now, new coal mines in the application process now. And some of these are the biggest coal mines in the world. You know, up to 40 and 50 million tonnes production a year.
Now, who owns these coal mines? Who's mining the coal?
Oh, mostly overseas companies like Anglo-American, Peabody, Xstrata from Switzerland, BHP, Billiton, of course.
And that's British. So, in other words, foreign companies are coming, are being allowed to come into Australia, and I could use a rude word, but I won't because Americans don't like swearing, destroying large parts of our country, but not just that, exporting the coal to China where it's used to make steel and all over the world, and adding enormously to global warming.
Oh, absolutely. And you know the irony of all of this is that while we are contributing by our exports to massive amounts of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere from overseas, we are also contributing to our own domestic greenhouse gas emissions just simply by digging up this coal.
Yeah.
Because when you dig up the coal, of course, you also allow to escape massive amounts of methane. And then, of course, you've got the considerable greenhouse gas emissions from transporting the coal and so on.
And digging it up.
Yeah, even before you put a match to it, you've got enormous greenhouse gas emissions.
And methane is 20 times more potent as a global warming gas than carbon dioxide, isn't
it? That's correct, yes. Yeah. We just by virtue of our new coal mines, new or expanded coal mines that we've got on the drawing board, we're actually going to increase our state's greenhouse gas emissions by about 15% per year. So,
Is that just from the mining?
That's not even before you put a match to it. That's right.
Okay, so what I want to know, Drew Hutton, is who gave these foreign companies permission to come in and destroy our country and help to destroy the world? The federal government or the state government of Queensland?
It's mostly the state government.
Is it really?
Yes, the state governments have control over land use planning in Australia, except where the effects can be on things that the federal government have some degree of control over, like the Great Barrier Reef or endangered species or endangered ecosystems. And the federal government, that's happened in a number of these cases. They've had to have federal government approvals and they've got them every time.
Well, Anna Bligh, who's the Premier of Queensland, it's like the governor in a state of America, she turned out to be quite a noble person during the flood. She went everywhere in a big hat and jeans and comforted people and reassured them and got them going. But she obviously is implicit in helping to cause the whole thing, right?
Yes, that's correct. That's one of the ironies of this whole situation. I know Anna personally.
Yeah.
She lives actually quite close to where I live here in Brisbane.
Yeah.
But and she's a nice person. But this government is just on tram tracks.
But have you talked to her about this, Drew? Have you talked to her about
it? I've talked to her government about it, and I've talked to the Premier's department. And
no,
I've
you need to talk to her.
Well, not all that easy to talk to the Premier, but the various people have talked to her, and I've certainly talked to her government at some length about it.
And what do they say?
They just say jobs.
It's the same with the nuclear industry.
Well, I say, we could cement over Moreton Bay, and that would create an awful lot of jobs, but why on earth would you want to do it?
What's Moreton Bay?
Moreton Bay is a beautiful bay that Brisbane is on. And the last thing you would do is something which would destroy it.
But that's not a good analogy because, to use a very awful analogy, I'm sure Hitler said that when he was building the gas ovens.
Yes,
it creates jobs.
Yes.
And actually,
that's a bit confounding, but it's...
In truth, we're creating the global gas oven by this incredible global warming.
I agree. I just think... it's all smoke and mirrors what happens with this government here. They on the one hand, they always carry on about all these renewable energy projects that they've got, and they'll be piffling little things, a 5-megawatt, renewable energy station parked outside some remote town, where at the same time they're digging up coal and massive amounts And, of course, the new coal seam gas industry, which I'm happy to talk about as well, which is going to contribute enormously too to global
warming. They're digging
warming.
It up as if there's no tomorrow. Why don't you just one morning, Sunday morning, go around and knock on Anna Bligh's door and say, I'm your next door neighbour and I've got to talk to you and sort of corner her and make her listen.
While I haven't personally confronted her myself about it, various others of us have, and in our movement up here, and really it's like talking to a brick wall, as it is to anybody else in her government. They've got this plan which is supposedly going to get them back into office. They're going to create 100,000 jobs, by the next election in this state, and 20,000 of them are going to be in the mining area.
Oh my God!
But what they don't tell people is that about two-thirds of those jobs are actually going to be only in the construction phase, which lasts a couple of years. And then after that, the maintenance stage of these projects has just a skeleton workforce, really.
Yeah.
And as well as that, the amount of environmental destruction, sometimes of the most beautiful farmland, beautiful productive farmland, is enormous. You're doing away with a whole generation of farmers and the accumulated wisdom and knowledge that they have. You're taking away workforce from areas in these country towns like the plumbing and local manufacturing and retail and all of those areas. People can't get a workforce. In 20 years' time, these country towns are going to be ghost towns. They're going to be leave behind them an industrial wasteland that'll never be productive again.
Yeah.
And for what? For a 20-year window.
I think it's
irresponsible.
All the profits go offshore.
That's right. Well, we get royalties from it, there'll be some sort of infrastructure. When that's balanced against the fact that this country, and as I say, some of it, you wouldn't find soil as lovely as this outside the Ganges Delta in some places,
really?
Of the Darling Downs.
Really?
And you're going to destroy it forever. It will never produce a thing ever again after these coal mines have gone over the top of it.
I'm almost speechless, actually.
I sometimes have to shake my own head about it. I'm right in the middle of it, and sometimes I pull back and look at it and I think, this can't be happening. Nobody could be as irresponsible
Stupid.
Or even as criminal as that is to do it.
Yeah, criminal. So how long has the coal industry been so big in Queensland? Because truly, I did not understand.
Oh, it began in the 60s.
60s.
Yes. That's when the big Japanese and American companies moved in with their open cut method.
Yeah.
Previously, it had been mostly underground mining and in fairly small mines. With the open cut coal mines, of course, it became much bigger and much more automated. And then you had the development of all these coal ports along the coast of Queensland and places like Gladstone and Mackay. And
huge ships
taking the coal offshore. Yeah, that's right.
And to India.
Well, Japan originally,
and Japan
is still a big source of it. But China and India, of course, are becoming much more.
And then you have the mountaintop removal for coal mining in the Appalachians in America, in the US, which is also criminal.
Oh, it's unbelievable! Yes.
Have you ever been? I've never seen it.
I've only seen photographs of it, but we're doing. In the same sort of way, it's different, but it's similarly irresponsible. We're actually putting some of these coal mines, or planning to put some of these coal mines, on floodplain farming land that produces two crops a year, incredibly productive country. In places like the Eastern Darling Downs. There's a little valley called Felton. Near Toowoomba, about 30 kilometres outside of the town of Toowoomba on the edge of the Darling Downs. And this valley reminds me, I think it must look something like one of those Welsh valleys did before they brought coal mining.
Green was my valley.
That's right, that one, yes. And just a beautiful, scenic, really pretty little place with these most incredibly fertile soils. They're going to put a huge coal mine and a coal-to-petrol plant right in the middle of it. It will destroy the whole valley, and 35% of the eggs from Queensland actually get produced in this valley along with lettuces and, you know, organic farms and all these crops. And the locals, they're saying, look, we'd much rather have windmills and solar panels on our fields. We're happy to do that. In fact, they even developed a plan for it. But instead, they're going to cop a massive great coal mine and a petrochemical plant.
It reminds me of, you know, a patient who's dying of septicemia, blood poisoning, and then every day you actually inject some more bacteria into the bloodstream, just hasten it along. That's what they're doing.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's just to get a government to the next election.
Also, Queensland could become the sort of energy superpower of the world in a way. It's bathed in sun all the time, has a lot of wind. I know it's got hot rock for geothermal energy. Mm. Just imagine how many people you could employ by creating with politicians who are knowledgeable, scientific, inspirational, and care about the future of the planet, not their own future.
Well, do you want to know another irony?
What?
We call ourselves the Sunshine State.
Yes.
And we have less solar power in this state than in any other state in Australia.
Okay, so here I'm volunteering. I feel right now like hopping in a plane or getting up there somehow and working with you side by side, Drew Hutton, to stop this madness. That really, coal madness it is.
Yeah.
Can I help?
Oh, undoubtedly. Can I talk about coal seam gas as well?
Yeah, I'll let you do that now.
Because
what is coal seam gas?
Okay, well, and this is, yeah, you can't talk about coal without coal seam gas and vice versa, because coal seam gas is what the Americans call coal bed methane.
It's methane.
Yeah,
that's
it's methane.
Inherent in the coal.
That's right, in the coal seam. So everywhere there's a coal seam, there's methane.
Yeah.
And the coal seam is also an aquifer. So there's water in there.
Yeah.
In order to get the methane out, they have to extract the water. It's all there under pressure, so all they need to do is drill down and the water comes up on its own.
Yeah.
To the surface. When it comes to the surface, they separate the water from the gas, and so massive amounts of water will be withdrawn from the what they call the balloon coal measures, which is a level of the Great Artesian Basin.
Now, please tell the audience what the Great Artesian Basin is, Drew.
Well, the Great Artesian Basin covers about one-fifth of the continent of Australia.
That's huge.
Oh, yes. It's one of the great natural wonders of the world, really, natural resource wonders of the world.
People should know that Australia is the same area as the United States.
Yes.
As large.
Yes, that's right.
And that water in the Great Artesian Basin is archaeological water, right?
That's right. It's about 250 million years old. The basin itself, the water itself is about 2 million years old, because it usually recharges in along the east coast from the mountain range on the east coast and flows westward into the middle of the country, where it comes up in various springs and so on. And these springs have been, of course, anthropologically very significant as well, and ecologically significant. But it takes about 2 million years to travel across there. It has various levels. They're interconnected to one extent or another, but they're largely self-contained. And the balloon coal measures is one level of this. Now, the whole system is under pressure, so that's why it's called artesian. Artesian just simply means, it's a French word, but it really means if you drill down into it, the pressure will force it to the surface.
Oh, really?
And so it's all under pressure. So if you actually dewater one whole level, which is what they're going to do to get this gas, they depressurize that level. And by doing that, they destabilize the whole basin.
The Great Artesian Basin.
That's correct. It means that water will flow from areas of high pressure to those areas of low pressure. So the water will flow out of other aquifers into the coal seam, because that's where the low pressure is. It'll find its way through the various interconnections, through the fissures in the rocks. Though some areas are more interconnected than others, so some areas will be more affected than others. But there will be some areas of the Great Artesian Basin, plus some more superficial aquifers that also have connections, that will be dewatered. That means that right across inland Australia, communities and irrigators will lose their water. And it is actually the Great Artesian Basin that, to a very great extent, allowed inland Queensland to be settled in the first place.
Oh, is
it's been very much overused by landowners and by country towns. They've been pretty profligate in the use of it over the years, but the last decade or so, they've made great steps in capping bores and sealing drains, so that in fact they're repressurising the whole system. It's getting back into shape again, and now we're going to extract something like 20 Sydney harbours of water. That is about 350,000 megalitres of water a year from that system. That is just going to cause the most enormous impacts on the whole system, which the experts, all of our experts, are saying could take centuries, up to 1,000 years, to restore.
I'm interviewing Drew Hutton, who is an environmental campaigner in Queensland, Australia, and he founded the Green Party in Queensland. So what you said in your note to me is absolutely amazing. The coal seam gas in this region, its main drawback is it threatens the Great Artesian Basin, which is what you've just said. The industry is massive. It will result in 40,000 plus gas wells along the hundreds of kilometres of pipelines, roads, compressor stations, liquid natural gas plants, etc.
That's correct.
There will be plenty of jobs created, but also massive environmental and social impacts.
Yes. I mean, let me just give you... I mean, I don't want to just quote figures at your audience, but there are four big companies so far that are going to be produced.
What companies?
ConocoPhillips.
Where's that located?
American company.
Yeah.
Is one.
Next.
British Gas.
Yeah.
Is another. Another is Petronas and Total.
That's from Brazil?
Petronas is Malaysian, I think.
Malaysian, yeah.
And Total is French.
Yeah.
They own a company called Arrow.
Yeah.
And the fourth one is Royal Dutch Shell.
Ah.
And they are going to be, they have this massive, biggest project in, well, if you put the all four together, it's the biggest project in Queensland's history, one of the biggest in Australia's history.
Oh, my God.
And they've already actually contracted for about 140 million tons of gas for sale to places like China. So it's just a huge project.
It's madness, isn't it?
It will produce... By their own estimates, and I think they're very much underestimating this, but 40 million tons of greenhouse gases a year. That's about 25% of increase on our state's greenhouse emissions.
But we're
already one of the biggest in the world.
But is that fugitive emissions, or is that all the gas that we sucked out and sent to China?
No, it's before it goes to a power station.
Oh.
So even before you burn it,
it's
creating those greenhouse gases. And they're created by fugitive emissions, by the energy required to extract, pump, liquefy the gas, and by the tree clearing that's needed. And by the way, we're going to be returning to rates of tree clearing in this state, which were a scandal back in the 1990s. And, this industry is actually exempt from the laws that govern landowners in terms of clearing trees. It's also exempt from the laws that govern extraction of water from the Great Artesian Basin, which landowners have to.
So trees are the one thing that everyone agreed on in Copenhagen, which would help to control global warming because they suck in carbon dioxide and use it for their metabolism and produce oxygen. So here we've got trees being cut down like there's no tomorrow in order to mine coal like there's no tomorrow, in order to suck out gas, methane, like there's no tomorrow, which will all add to carbon dioxide and global warming and destroy farming land, the richest farming land probably in Australia, for the rest of time, so that we hasten global warming so our babies, I'm in a house with a baby aged 13 months called Archie, who's the most glorious thing you've ever seen, he'll have no future.
Yeah.
Right, so I think, Drew Hutton, you should write an article, a summary of everything you've just said to me about the Great Artesian Basin, the forest, the coal and the gas, and summarise it for an op-ed piece in either the Sydney Morning Herald or the Australian, which are two major papers in Australia.
You know what? There's still a myth. Oh, I've actually done this and not been published, because there's still this myth out there, and it's really strong, that somehow gas is a, everyone accepts that coal is terrible, but there's a myth that gas is clean and green. And in fact, much of the research which is currently being done shows that gas, including, I might add, by the American EPA, the US EPA, is showing that, in fact, gas is hardly better, if at all better, than coal in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. There are some writers, in fact, some researchers, a guy called Howarth from Cornell Uni being one of them, saying it's actually worse than coal when you do a total carbon footprint of the
industry. Oh, of extraction and the whole thing.
Yeah.
No, but you didn't answer my question about writing the piece. I wanted
I've written quite a bit.
No, but it's got to be published in the national newspapers for people, in conjunction with the recent catastrophic flooding in Queensland. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Tied in with that.
Yeah. Oh, look, I'm happy to do that.
That's an order, Drew.
And Helen, I know you well enough to know what an order means. but look, as well as getting the information out there, which we are doing, and by the way, the movie Gaslands has been excellent for that.
Oh, good.
And Gaslands has been, I see, nominated for an Academy Award.
Oh, good.
And Josh Fox, its maker, has been out here, and I've had quite a bit to do with Josh, and he's coming back out again in March. So he's been a very good ally for us, and we're developing a movement, and it's one that really is quite unique in history. For this country anyway, it's a Green Farmer Alliance. I mean, the farmers and the greenies in Australia have been basically enemies, forever.
Now, explain to the American audience what a greenie is.
A greenie is an environmental campaigner.
Yeah.
Somebody who, goes out there and fights for the trees and the animals and the, and the air and so on. And, of course, along the way, that's brought us into conflict with farmers because for example, tree clearing. That was one, but there have been various others. In fact, when I first went out to the went out west on this issue, it was about April of last year.
Yeah,
I started going out there and talking to people, and
to the farmers.
To farmers, yes. I spent the first month to 6 weeks just simply travelling around talking to farmers.
Yeah,
and The local, it's called Country Life. It's the country newspaper, basically, for farmers. 10 years ago, they were basically saying, if he comes into town, shoot him. I was enemy number one out there. And these days, they're calling me the saviour of the bush. So, you've just got to live long enough.
Well, it is an amazing alliance, because farmers are traditionally in Australia extremely conservative. And they have bumper stickers like killer greenie and that sort of thing.
Yeah, state of the earth, plant a greenie.
State of the earth, plant a greenie.
Yeah. I walked onto one guy, when I was going around talking to people, I walked onto one guy's front veranda and he said, "You're Drew Hutton, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You're the bastard who caused all my problems in the first place." He was talking about tree clearing, you see. I said, "Oh, does that mean you don't want to talk to me?" "Oh, no, I want to talk to you. Come on in, have a cup of tea, meet the wife. Let me tell you about these gas companies."
And so how strong is the farming lobby now, would you say, Drew Hutton?
Well, they're not. There's a Labor government in power in Queensland. And
explain
of course,
what a Labor government
well,
is.
Well, Labor's similar to the Democratic Party in the United States.
Yeah.
So it'd be centre or left of centre in its politics. Certainly not voted for by rural people. You basically don't get Labor electorates in the country.
Yeah.
I mean, in provincial cities maybe, but not in the country. And so, of course, a Labor government couldn't care less what the farmers want. They're not going to be subject to lobbying by them. So this is what I said to farmers originally when I went out there. You are not going to win this by fighting it west of the Great Dividing Range.
Well, what's the Great Dividing Range?
Sorry. The Great Dividing Range basically is a range along the eastern coastline of Australia that divides the coastal population from the inland
population. And it goes all the way up.
All the way up the coast.
Yeah, it's a long, 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 long range.
Yes. And so I said, you're not going to win it by just fighting it in the bush.
The bush?
The country.
We call the country in rural areas the bush.
Yes.
For those who don't know, you're hearing a lot of Australian idioms.
Yeah, sorry about
that.
That's all right. Yes, I'm afraid I'm a bit of a country boy myself.
So now, okay, so what are your plans with the farmers, Drew Hutton? You're a greenie. They're the farmers. How can we, it seems to me what we need to do is mobilise the city people now to understand the impact of what's happening on global warming, A. B, all the profits are going offshore, almost all. C, it doesn't create many jobs. D, it's destroying the farmland. I mean, that's why you've got to get these articles published.
Yes, well, and also to link up the city and the country.
The city and the country.
That's been my most important project.
Yes, and how's it going? What are you doing?
Oh, really well. Gasland, the movie, has been very important for that. We show the movie and then I usually give a bit of a talk after it. I've been just getting the information out through the various environmental networks in particular.
Yes.
And, in fact, many of the environmental groups now are coming very much on board. And young campaigners are starting to see this as the key issue of our era, really.
Yeah, well, it is. It's their future life. What about the Liberal Country Party, which for Americans and Canadians is the Republican Party? They represent the farmers. Can't they be brought in online and educated?
Well, they should be able to. And some of them are showing, you know, some degree of concern about it. But they, at this point, they're very much on the side of the mining companies, whether it's coal or coal seam gas.
Well, we've got to stop it. I mean, I want to get rid of nuclear weapons and close down all nuclear power plants and stop uranium mining. But this is as urgent and as important as that, because global warming is occurring far faster than the world's scientists predicted.
Yeah. Look, it's the issue of our times. It's the crusade of our times, really.
It's a crusade.
Yeah. And, I mean, we've got to the point here where the both government and opposition, you know, are on the other side. Mm. The federal government's on the other side.
Yep.
So we've started this campaign called Lock the Gate.
Yeah.
And basically it's a sort of Gandhian non-cooperation campaign.
Yeah.
Where we call on farmers, and we've got over 1,000 farmers have joined the movement so far. They're just saying, we've locked our gate. We are not going to allow the companies onto our land. Because what we've got here in this state, and it's similar to other states, a mining company, and it's similar to the situation in the Americas too, I might add, a mining company can take out an exploration permit over an area, a mining tenement, and they then can get access to your land.
So steal it?
Well, they get access to it. They don't.
What does that mean?
That means that they can go onto your property, first of all, to conduct trials and various tests to see whether it's suitable for their mining. And then if it is, they can apply for a mining lease. Now, they have to, do it sometimes, not always, do an environmental impact assessment on it.
And then they can dig up your property.
Yes, they can. And they've introduced legislation here in Queensland now which says that to do that, they send you a letter if you're the landowner. Then you have to enter negotiations with the company about how they will come onto your property and what compensation they'll give you. If you can't come to an agreement within 20 days, then they can take you to compulsory mediation. If after a further 20 days you still can't come to an agreement, they can take you to the land court, which is one of the courts that we have in this country for this purpose. As soon as it goes to the land court, even before the land court makes a decision about this, as soon as it goes to the land court, they can enter your property. And if you try to obstruct them from entering your property, you are subject to up to $50,000 fine.
Jeez.
Now, that's within 50 days of a company sending you a letter to access your property. They can do so, and they can fine you, and the state can fine you $50,000 if you try and stop them.
Well,
from doing
how can the farmers stop it? Locking the gates, all very well and good, but
they're going to go to jail, and so will I. We're going to resist these companies from coming onto properties. That's how desperate the whole thing is. We're going to be sitting down in front of these trucks and bulldozers and so on coming onto properties, and we're not going to allow it to happen. In fact, there's a community out at Tara. Your listeners might know Tara only from Gone with the Wind. The movie Gone with the Wind, but it's actually a little town.
Oh, what about the United States of Tara?
No, that's right, of course, yes, with an Australian actress in it. It's a little township, actually, in Western Queensland, and there's a rural residential estate outside Tara, which has got the biggest gas bubble in Queensland underneath it. The company is desperate to get on, but the community there are saying, you cannot come on, and if you come on, we will resist you. Non-violently, but, you know, we will resist you. And it's a standoff. So that's probably going to be the first salvo in this particular...
soon will that happen, Drew?
Well, it could happen at any time. We're organising a big festival, actually, at Tara on the 1st of May. It'll go for 5 days, and it'll be, entertainment, workshops, talks, but it'll also be direct action. We're going to lock this company down, for those 5 days.
And what company is it?
Well, the company's British Gas.
Oh, British Gas.
But there are
Gas.
Various other companies out there. There's ConocoPhillips is active in the area as well.
I'll come up to the festival.
That would be lovely to have you.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you, one of the things that, people are saying is, oh, well, we don't want coal or coal seam gas, but maybe nuclear is an option.
I know.
Okay. Well, if you want to jump out of the frying pan.
Into the nuclear fire. Yeah, right.
But, we badly need a respectful discussion about it. You know, I'm not going out there, lecturing to farmers and telling them what they should think and all the rest of it. You know, you have to be respectful. And this alliance that's building between environmentalists and farmers is too important to go hectoring people about treating them disrespectfully. So, it needs to be a debate and a rational discussion, but
educational.
Yeah,
yes.
I think it can. I think it'll be a very significant event and a very significant development in the move towards a sustainable society.
Well, we've got to win this one, Drew.
I agree. Well, at my age, I wasn't really looking for another big campaign, but unfortunately,
you?
I think I've got the biggest in my 40 years of activism.
How old are you?
64.
Oh, my God.
My wife was actually looking forward to a nice retirement. But anyway, I blame her because she's the one who got me into this.
Oh, yeah, you can always blame your wife. Or blame your husband.
Yep.
Yeah, well, you're only 8 years younger than me. So, yeah, well, you just have to keep going, really, don't you, until you get into your coffin.
At least another 8 years, eh? Oh, dear. I better tell my wife that.
I mean, I'm going to keep going till I can't.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, what use is there inhabiting a place on this earth when all you're doing is creating more greenhouse gases, more consumption, more waste? I can't be a hedonist. I can't be happy unless I'm contributing. Do you feel like that?
Yes, very much so. It's a burden, but...
It's a joyful burden because you know you're doing the right thing.
Well, it's the responsibility of our age is the way I look at it. You know, every generation is given a particular responsibility and has a particular imperative that they have to address, and this is ours. You know, we actually are the generation and the next generation, of course, my children and your children and so on, are the next generation that has to... take up this mantle and...
Well, we've got to stop it. Now, you know what occurs to me, Drew Hutton, is that maybe we could ask Dr. James Hansen to come out to Queensland And he would be welcomed, I'm sure, in the Brisbane Town Hall, which is the main capital city.
Yes, he would. Yeah.
And we could get tremendous publicity by, I've got contacts. In fact, I've interviewed him for this radio program. What do you think of that idea?
Oh, that would be a wonderful idea. That would be wonderful. And I mean, James has just done some terrific work, including, I might add, some good direct action.
I know.
He's been arrested over there.
Yeah, he's been arrested at the mountaintop removal for
coal. Yeah, so he's a good man, a courageous man, and a very smart man.
The only thing is he's pro-nuclear.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, we'll have to tell him that he can't talk about
it. Oh, he's still very welcome to come out. So,
do you think you could raise the money for that?
Oh, we'll give it a go, yeah.
Okay.
We're not a rich movement, but people are just digging in their pockets for this one because it's just so important.
It's the future of the planet. Thank you very much, Drew Hutton, for appearing on this program. It's been absolutely fascinating. Only one of the most important issues facing the human race and all other species. I'm sure we'll be talking again in the future with further developments, hopefully positive and not negative ones. And once again, I thank you.
Thank you, Helen. Lovely talking to you again.
Okay,
bye.
On If You Love This Planet Today, I've been speaking with Drew Hutton, an environmental campaigner in his home state of Queensland, Australia, and spokesperson for Friends of the Earth, Brisbane, and for the Green Party. This is a little taste of things to come from a speech I gave recently in Port Hope, Canada. Thank you for having me here. I am disappointed that I'm not actually in Port Hope in the church. I have had a long experience in Canada, first from the Canadian Film Board that made the film If You Love This Planet, which I didn't like very much at all, but which won an Oscar. The film was made in Plattsburgh, New York. I was talking about the medical effects of nuclear war. And the US Justice Department has banned that film as foreign propaganda, along with two films on acid rain, all made by the Canadian Film Board. The issue was so contentious that it went up to the Supreme Court and it's still banned. And so my whole trip, I'm here for a month. I've spoken in Troy, New York. I've been in Houston, Texas, Seattle, Vancouver, where I spoke at the Children's Hospital there to my colleagues, is centred around Port Hope. And so the fact that I wasn't allowed to go there and was prevented by the mayor didn't bode well, I thought, for the people of Port Hope, because I only came to tell you the medical facts, and it's clear that she doesn't have them. What I'm going to do now is walk you through the whole nuclear fuel cycle from beginning to end and where you are within that fuel cycle. So I'm going to start at the beginning. Your facility at Port Hope started in 1933, as you all know, and refined radium from pitch blend. Now, Madame Curie, who actually discovered radiation and who refined radium first, she was so fascinated by it, she used to walk around with a little lump of radium in the pocket of her lab coat. She subsequently died of leukemia because radium goes to bone. It's a bone seeker, and it causes cancer and leukemia. And then her daughter also died of leukemia. The medical literature is replete with articles about radiation and cancer. The old radiologists who first started x-raying people used to put their hand in the beam of the x-ray to see how strong or weak it was. Many of them died of cancer. Then we've got the Hiroshima and Nagasaki data from which we derive all our standards for medicine. I won't go into that. I have written 7 books on this subject and on nuclear war. This one is for sale at the back. Nuclear power is not the answer. And if you read this, like I had to read Gray's Anatomy to learn to be a doctor, you will find most of the answers and you'll be able to debate with knowledge. And never forget, your politicians represent you, not the nuclear commissions, not the corporations, but you. And unless you become well educated and use your democracy, they will not represent you and you will not be able to educate them. They will be in the hands of the corporations, and look at the United States at this time. Okay, now, Your uranium in Canada was used for the first nuclear weapons, and it was refined at Port Hope. The first bomb was called Trinity, named after the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. There was an outside possibility that when they blew it up, because they'd never done this before, that the whole atmosphere could be rendered critical and everyone would die. And the physicists were taking bets as they were hiding in their foxholes waiting for the bomb to explode, whether or not that would happen. But they went ahead anyway. If the bomb had not worked according to plan, they were sent a telegram to the President, Roosevelt, "It's a girl." The bomb worked, and the telegram read, "It's a boy." And Robert Oppenheimer, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, as he watched the bomb explode, he muttered to himself a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, "I have become death, the shatterer of worlds," knowing that he'd captured the energy inside the stars, and that energy could be used inappropriately to destroy life on the planet. He also said at that time, for the first time, physicists have known sin, and they've been sinning ever since. So when and the radium that was refined was used for various things. We used to use it in medicine before we realized how dangerous it was. We've done a lot of bad things in medicine, and we realized later what we've done. It was used to paint the dials of watches with radium paint so it glowed in the dark, and the women who did that used to lick the brushes to make them nice and pointy so the figures would be accurate. They all swallowed a lot of radium, which is very soluble. It was absorbed through the gut and went to the bone like calcium. And many of those women, the majority, died of either leukemia, which is cancer of the white blood cells, or cancer of the maxilla or mandible. So from that sort of classic group of people, we learned about what radium means. There's a lot of radium in Port Hope. So that the radium was made, and then the facility, El Dorado, run by the Canadian government, moved in to making uranium, to put in nuclear reactors to make the weapons. And the first three bombs were derived from Port Hope. Trinity, little boy that was dropped on Hiroshima, killed about 120,000 people in a flash of light. Some people survived Hiroshima and ran to the only Christian centre in Japan, thinking America would never bomb that. That was Nagasaki. And they arrived 3 days later for the second bomb called Fat Man, and about 80,000 people were killed there. So that was the beginning, and Port Hope was an integral part of that. Port Hope continued to make and refine the uranium to be used in the military reactors in America till 1957. So you instigated partly, not you, you weren't even alive then, but I was, instigated the initial part of the whole nuclear arms race. After 57, El Dorado kept making rods for nuclear reactors, and they sold it, 22 years ago or something, to Cameco. A very scary corporation. They want to mine uranium in Australia, incidentally. But I'll get into Cameco in a little while. So you've got a lot of uranium. Some of the world's richest resided in Saskatchewan. Now, uranium has two isotopes, 238 and 235. This is only present in 0.7%. And this is the fissionable one. This does not fission. You understand fission? The atoms breaking apart. So you have to enrich this to 3% to be used in nuclear power. If you enrich it to 50% or more, you can make bombs out of it, like Fat Man that was dropped on Nagasaki. That's why they're worried that Iran, who is developing enrichment facilities, will have the ability not just to make nuclear power plants, but to make bombs. So we at the moment are the biggest irradiators of the public, doctors. Number one. Number two, never ever have an unnecessary x-ray. Radiation is cumulative. There is no safe dose. A definitive study done several years ago by the National Academy of Sciences called the BEAR-7 report, Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, says there's no safe dose. And it's cumulative. Each dose you receive adds to your risk of getting cancer
already the background radiation produces a fair number of cancers we already see. Background radiation produced our evolution when the Earth was much hotter radiologically. So genes mutated and changed, fish developed lungs, birds developed wings over billions of years, and finally this wonderful species of us, Homo sapiens, evolved with a huge neocortex and an opposing thumb. So we now control the planet and 30 million other species that cohabit with us. So radiation has induced evolution, but most mutations, and I'll explain that in a minute, are deleterious, they cause disease. And it takes many eons of time for advantageous mutations to arise to produce fish with lungs, birds with wings, and the like. Alpha emission, and I'll go through all of this, is a particulate emitted from a radioactive nucleus composed of two protons and two neutrons. It's dense in mass, and it can be blocked by a piece of paper. So uranium is an alpha emitter. If you hold it in your hand, it won't penetrate the dead layers of skin to damage living cells. But if you inhale it into your lung, the alpha particle is dense, it travels only a short distance, and most of the cells in that volume die. But as radiation decreases with the square of the distance, some cells on the periphery of that volume survive. And what happens is that there is a gene, I'm being simplistic now because it's a very famous geneticist in the audience, there's a gene that controls the rate of cell division in the cell. You know, the cell has 46 chromosomes and there are genes, many, many genes. But if that gene is hit by the alpha particle in a random way and the cell is not killed, the gene changes biochemically. You know the DNA molecule, the double helix? And the cell will sit silently and cryptogenically for 5 to 60 years. You don't even know you've been damaged by radiation, you feel fine, and one day you cough up some blood. Then you have to have a chest x-ray. The risk is minimal compared to the diagnosis of your cancer. And the doctor tells you you've got cancer. Now, no cancer wears a sign saying, I was made by some radon you inhaled 20 years ago. No cancer identifies its origin. The only way to work out if there's an increased incidence in an exposed population, such as Port Hope, is to take the whole population and follow them from birth to death. And if they move, find out where they've moved and follow them, then do autopsies on all of them and compare that exposed population to a non-exposed population to see if there's a higher than normal incidence of cancer. That's never been done in Port Hope. And the government is criminally negligent for not following up people living with Port Hope.
That was an excerpt from a speech I gave in Port Hope, Canada. You'll hear the full speech on the next program of If You Love This Planet next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.